I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. What a week. We're at the end of the week. Thank goodness for that. Some technical issues, I think it's fair to say, on the show today. Coming up in the main part of the show, the episode, I speak to Robert Winston, Professor Robert Winston. We talk about child development during the pandemic, what happens when scientists become celebrities and we end up with T-shirts and mugs and all that sort of thing, of the people advising the Prime Minister, and what benefits technology might bring us in the future. That's coming up as the main thing. First, though, the columnist panel, which unfortunately, just as this was starting, was when all of my technology fell over on the show. So instead, here's Stig Abel with Robert Crampton and Esther Webber.
Let's talk about the 24/7 vaccine confusion. I think this is a really interesting story. Boris Johnson has been saying COVID vaccinations will be offered after 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as soon as supply allows. But Nadeem Zahawi has said that rather than offer 24-hour vaccines, we should focus on the most vulnerable. Robert, is the issue here we don't actually know where the problem in getting the vaccine out is, because the government won't tell us whether they've got loads of vaccine and it's a question of needing 24 hours to push it out, or they haven't got enough vaccine? The suspicion is it's the latter, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm confused because I thought we had 20 million doses of certainly one of the vaccines, but now they're saying to do the 2 million a week, they haven't got the supply to do that at the moment, which indicates that we haven't got 20 million or we haven't got 20 million sitting there. From what I've read, there's a problem. It's not a problem with production; it's a problem with packaging it up and getting the final safety checks signed off. So, if anything should be going 24/7, it sounds like it ought to be that, rather than you can't vaccinate people if you haven't got the vaccine, and also you can't vaccinate them if over half of them don't want a vaccine between midnight and six, which is what our survey said this morning.
Yeah. There's a funny thing, Esther, that because I've asked ministers this question. You never get an answer, which is no surprise in some respects. The national security argument, that we can't tell you how many vaccines we've got for reasons of national security. Do you buy that?
No. I mean, national security, that's the sort of catch-all, isn't it, when they haven't got an answer or they don't want to give you the answer that they have got.
Yeah, Esther, what...
Security, I can't see where there's a national security consideration.
Esther, what's the specious thinking about that?
I suppose I think there has been some anxiety about any potential revelation of the location of the vaccines and the potential for someone to try and half inch them, basically. But I don't see really how the numbers actually play into that. And it would seem to be that, as Robert said, really the focus should be on deploying them as fast as we can, rather than this theory of giving them overnight, which does sound very attractive, not least of all because it would give us a reason to leave the house in the evening. Yeah. But I think the evidence shows that not many people actually take up late night appointments when they're offered.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could take a drink with us, take a tinny with us and call it a night out. That's not a terrible idea, Esther. You wrote a piece yesterday which I thought was interesting, the sort of rebirth of target culture, focusing on numbers. And there's two theories on this. One, that if you focus on big numbers, you always just end up misleading because you just try and hit the number, whatever the cost. And we saw that probably in testing. But there's a kind of Blairite argument, isn't there, which is if you constantly yammer on about numbers, you actually get things moving.
Yeah, it was interesting. I suppose with all the talk about hitting the target of the four most vulnerable groups by the middle of February and the 100,000 testing target back in last spring, I wondered whether target culture was having a bit of a moment. And we're used to thinking of it maybe as quite a negative thing, something associated with kind of the worst box ticking of the New Labour era. But yeah, there's an argument on both sides. And I think from the people I spoke to for this piece, it seems like no one really denies that there can be good outcomes from setting targets because it does speed things up. It puts pressure on the whole system, but it does mean there will be negative outcomes elsewhere, and I don't think anyone denies that either, but it's kind of whether the scale of the effort is worth some of the other things that may get missed along the way.
Yeah, it's a very fair point. Another story doing the rounds, Northern Policy Foundation says moving 50,000 civil servants out of London to the north of England could give the region a £3 billion economic boost. It's proposing moving the Treasury to Leeds, the Home Office to Newcastle and the Department of Health to Liverpool. Robert Crampton, this is one of those ideas that actually, if everyone was to think fairly about this, generally for the good of the economy and the country, it would happen. But because it involves actually moving people who don't live in those places to those places, it will never happen.
I'm not sure about that. We've done it over the years. We moved the DVLA to Swansea and the DSS went to Newcastle and the passport office is in Liverpool, isn't it? We saw this when the BBC went to Salford. There's a huge outcry and then a few people moan and a few people refuse to go, and then everything settles down and the world doesn't come to an end and it's actually a good thing. I think this is a good thing. It's obviously a good thing for the North. I think it's a very good thing for London as well. It would reduce pressure on housing and it would reduce pressure on transport. And I mean, coming from the North as I do, I know people who work in the public sector, civil servants, teachers, local government officials who have a very good quality of life in the North, which they don't necessarily have in the South. So whether it will happen or not, I don't know, but it should happen.
Yeah, Esther, there's an argument I've often felt for moving Parliament to another city. In countries where they have these sort of parallel big cities where the financial sector and the administrative governmental sector are in different cities, you tend to get more equality. Do you feel, start with the departments, do you think the departments might ever move?
It's a tricky one. I feel like these stories come up, you know, every couple of months and no one really disagrees that decentralisation would be a good thing. And as Robert said, we've managed some incremental change. But I think the problem is you really need something much more radical. You need something bigger. You need some of the senior people to be deployed around the country and the kind of centres of decision making. And that's the thing which is going to require like real political will. And this government has said they are the ones to do it. So let's see if they can put their money where their mouth is.
And happily, we've managed to have that whole conversation without mentioning the term levelling up. So well done to all of us. We'll give ourselves a prize later. Esther, you've got a piece in the paper today. We mentioned it on our show briefly. Wheelchair users being denied access to the new Big Ben.
Yeah, so obviously this is a project that's been going on for 4 years now. We've had Big Ben under scaffolding, one of the most iconic landmarks in the country. And it's been confirmed just recently that the lift, which is being built as part of the renovation, won't actually be wide enough to accommodate visitors in wheelchairs. And I'm told by some of the people who were involved in signing off the project that that was put forward as one of the main reasons for the huge escalation in costs. And now we're told that's not going to happen. And there are conservationists and other people involved with the project who say, look, it was never going to be possible because of the sort of extremely narrow design constraints they're operating on. It does seem like they probably could have spotted that 4 years ago rather than just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. Robert, just lastly, what's in your column this week?
I'm writing about making up silly songs at home to pass the time with the children. Well, you take a well-known tune and you put your own lyrics to it, most of which are unrepeatable because they're usually slanderous, defamatory lyrics about famous people or family members and so on. And anyway, it's just a way of, we're all finding ways to pass the time, and that's one of ours.
How old are your kids, Robert?
Shamefully, they're 23 and 21.
Oh, God, so in my mind, I was saying, I'm about to share my thoughts. I have an 11 and 9 and a 2-year-old. And right. We do that a lot about bums. So we often take songs.
Yeah. No, we still do that. That never gets old.
Really, that's good, because we've got a long lockdown ahead of us possibly still. And you guarantee me that bums will still work.
Bums will never go away.
Esther Webb and Robert Crampton there. They both write for The Times every week. You can read Robert in Times 2 and in the Saturday magazine in The Times. And Esther obviously writes the Times Web Box Monday to Wednesday, the daily political email from The Times. You can read them both, but you're going to need to get yourself a digital Times subscription. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/Times Web Box. Up next is that interview with Robert Winston.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Now it's time for our big interview.
Let's talk to Professor Robert Winston. The pandemic has been tough on everyone, but especially on children. Lessons have gone virtual, exams have been cancelled, and of course, lots of friends have been missed. Even before birth, the cruel impact on pregnant women separated from partners for key scans and treatments and even long stages of labour early on. It's been incredibly tough too. While we're all grimly aware, I think, of the immediate impact of coronavirus, the death toll rising again and again, we're less clear, I think, on the long-term impacts of the turmoil on young people. So who better to discuss this with than a man who's a hero to many for his work on IVF and a great chronicler of childhood through his landmark TV series, Child of Our Time. Professor Robert Winston, welcome to Times Radio.
Yes, good morning to you.
I was thinking when I knew that you were coming on the show, I was just sort of thinking, science for a time maybe wasn't quite so cool, but now, you know, scientists are the new rock stars.
Oh, science has always been cool, and it's been cool since the time of Aristotle, and Archimedes. I think science is cool, and I think it's interesting to consider that really you know, in the 17th century, we had all those aristocrats doing scientific experiments in their home observatories. So nothing's really changed. I made telescopes as a child. When I was about 10 or 11, I made my first telescope, and I ground my first mirror when I was 13. So, you know, I think it was just it's a long tradition.
It must be quite nice for you, though, to see that, you know, instead of celeb reality TV stars and people being famous for the sake of being famous, you know, one of the some of the most famous, coolest people in the country right now with T-shirts and mugs, that Chris Whitty and Jonathan Van Tam and Patrick Vallance and so on.
I'm very worried by that, because I think seeing scientists as celebrities is really very dangerous, because I think one of the real problems we have at the moment in society is that scientists are, it's very difficult not to become arrogant because you think you know everything. And I think it's very, very important for us to be extremely modest and to recognize that we have failings. And if we don't, there's a risk that we bring science into disrepute. And that certainly happened to some extent during the pandemic. I think that, you know, we're seen as being, you know, absolutely infallible, or at least we were presented as infallible, but we know perfectly well we're not. And I think the real risk for people like me is to be very authoritarian, top down. And I think, you know, one of the big issues in our society, and this is a really important issue with regard to children as well, is that we tend to be, let's say, we don't communicate, we actually message. And communication requires listening. And of course, we can't influence the public unless we actually listen to the worries and try and respond to them and actually are truthful. And as we've seen over the last year, there have been so many untruths about what's going on, including the education of children and the uncertainties. And I think we have to recognize that those uncertainties are very, very important, and we have to acknowledge them and try to convey them in a way which is not unreassuring to the public.
When you say untruths, do you mean saying things like we are going to open schools and them not happening, or more specific examples of where things have been said which aren't really the case?
Well, I think from the very start, you know, the first thing that nobody remembers is that in fact the pandemic was predicted in the House of Lords, which in which I sit, by Lord Patel in November, not last November, but the November before last. Really 5 months before lockdown, when we recognized in the House of Lords that there was this new virus coming out of Wuhan, and we were concerned about it. And we presented, this was presented in a debate during the House of Lords, and it was not taken any notice of. And actually, over the last 15 years, I and many other Lords have sat on committees predicting that there was going to be a pandemic, but we've not been listened to. And of course, it's understandable that you're not listened to if in fact, you know, you're not respected. And people are not, sometimes people are not respected because they've been so didactic or so authoritarian in what they've presented. And I think we didn't do a great job in communicating that very well. And I think the government has followed that also by communicating very poorly, by constantly switching its line. And I think that's been a big problem. We've seen it in education. I mean, we're here to talk about education. And the fact of the matter is that schools have been in absolute chaos. Heads have really had a real problem because one minute they're closing down, next minute they're not. They don't have enough money. They've not been given any extra resources, really, to deal with the most important part of our population. You know, the most important part of the population in the pandemic is the next generation, because they are what are going to supply the future of our society. And we've really got a problem there, I think, that we've got to try and solve.
OK, well, let's focus on children then. It struck me that it's now 21 years since you began Child of Our Time, where you chronicled the lives of 25 children born at the turn of the century. What a time for them to have come of age, you know, just at the point, you know, turning 21 this year, and their future is so uncertain.
Well, the future is always uncertain. and I mean, my future was uncertain. I left school without knowing what the hell I was going to do. I had a place which I didn't take at university because I was uncertain I wanted to do natural sciences. And I ended up, by default, suddenly applying for medical school after I'd left my senior education, and ended up as a doctor. And I soon realized that actually medicine was not something I wanted to practice at that time because it was so authoritarian. I left, and I went eventually into theatre, which actually was one of the best things I could have done, because I learned then how to communicate, and then I came back into science, and of course have run, you know, science in a laboratory and so on, and managed a group of people. And I think what I've learned actually is that it's not really knowledge that's important. That's why we're so poor in our education. It's not the facts that matter. It's actually how you collaborate and how you communicate, which actually really breeds success. And I think that running a group of people and collaborating with people is the most important single thing we could teach every young person in this country. You know, we are living in a competitive system rather than a collaborative one. And I think that's not to the advantage of children.
We all know that the children benefit as well, just from being with each other, playing together, learning together. What impact has it had that they haven't been in school for so many weeks in the past 12 months, losing those social links?
Well, I think your question nails one of the biggest problems. And I think what we've forgotten is that primary school children, you know, it doesn't matter whether they're learning the curriculum that much. What matters is that their inquiry is being answered and that their ability to interface with other children of the same age is possible. And of course, the biggest thing that's been missing has been socialization. And that's been very, very unfortunate. Children have become quite often very, very unhappy at the age of 6, 7, 8, 9, because of course they're missing their friends. And for them, going back to school is much more about going back to their friends than it is about going back to some formal education. And it's a very important deprivation. And of course, that deprivation is compounded in poorer societies. One of the big problems in Britain is that we have very uneven, as you know, of course, you know, I was lucky, I went to a school that was very well funded, but most children don't. And if you go around the coastal of South Coast, for example, the Essex coast, if you go up to the Yorkshire coast, if you go up to the northeast or the northwest, you see massive deprivation, which is true in the big cities as well. And that actually, I think, is a big problem for our children. They have that lack of socialization is not helpful.
It just seems to be something that constantly drops off the sort of the radar as well. I mean, just this week we've had the row about these free school meal packages, and you know, but that was the how do parents who normally get free school meals when their children go to school cope during the schools being shut? That was a debate in March, April, and May last year. It just doesn't seem to be a sort of a firm grip on all of those issues.
It's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. And congratulations to Rashford too for really trying to sort out the government. Amazing, what a good thing for a professional footballer. It's usually rather reviled, you know, as being people who are useful to our society. He did something really useful. He used his profile to really change that. And it was a nonsense, you know. It was absolutely unbelievable that the Department of Education, you know, Gavin Williamson has to take responsibility for that. Could argue that really we weren't going to provide these poorer families with meals, because of course what was failed to recognise that educationally, if you are hungry and if you're starving, you do not learn. Your brain doesn't function so well. And of course, that, if it's prolonged, leads to lower educational ability and cognitive impairment. So actually, by actually having a group of children who are not well funded for a proper diet is a long-term problem, even though it may only be lasting for a year or two during their development.
And what sort of long-term impact can that have? Because I suppose that's the thing that lots of people are asking themselves, is that what impact will the last few months have on the next few years?
Well, I'm not too concerned about that, because I think on the main, although, one of my areas, of course, is genetics. And of course, more recently, it's how our genes respond to our environment, epigenetics it's called. And I think what we know from epigenetics is that the human is amazingly resilient. So, of course, you can return to very good cognitive ability and cognitive function. But you won't do that, of course, if you're not supplied with the educational needs. Now, I want to come back to something, if I may, that you said at the very beginning about, you know, it's 21 years since The Child of Our Time finished, you know, after 21 years since it started. And, you know, now, of course, children are facing a very uncertain time. I think we should look at this very differently. I think we should look at this as the most massive opportunity for our society, because here we have a real chance to reevaluate what we're doing, and particularly reevaluate education. And I think that means, for example, really deciding, is this syllabus that we're so hooked on that important? Is it not more important to give children a broader education, which includes collaboration, socialization, and so on, which include, so for example, even going up to the, and I speak from somebody who's now working, of course, as you appreciate, at a Russell Group University, which is, you know, very high powered science. But actually, whilst that's important, far more people are really needing a broader education. And of course, the A-levels in some ways don't do that. They actually confine people to more knowledge, which they could probably look up in a book about their subject, and not enough about the background, the ethics, the social consequences, the arguments, the ability to analyze, and so on. And I think we miss that. So the opportunity is really here for us to do something about that. And the other thing, of course, is that what children are not being told is that actually there are golden opportunities for them too, because, of course, look at what's happened in the last year. The amazing, as you pointed out, the burgeoning of science. It's absolutely extraordinary what has happened in science. And suddenly also, it's not just the sciences, the humanities and the arts. You know, suddenly we're realizing how much we miss in the arts as a result of the pandemic, and how we need to protect them much more vigorously. And the government hasn't yet taken that on board, but I hope it will in due course. And as for the humanities, of course, the humanities are very much at the core of what we should be doing in our education. We should all be able to, you know, use language properly and not just simply be communicating on Twitter, which of course uses language, and actually, well, it, you know, it actually debases language. It debases argument. So not be taught to look at a structure of an argument rationally.
And what about the you touched on it slightly there, the question of A-levels and GCSEs and SATs. I mean, all cancelled again this year. If you'd have suggested that a couple of years ago, you know, people have thrown them out, you know, people have thought the world would have stopped turning. And yet children will progress and they'll move on to the next stage and all of that. Do you think there's an opportunity to completely rethink the amount of testing?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And of course, you know, for the last year, a lot of us have been saying, well, why are these exams so important? Because in fact, you know, when I went to university to do medicine, virtually, I mean, nothing that I'd learnt in school really taught me anything about doing medicine. You know, it was my general knowledge was much more important. You know, the ability to read a decent book or manage an argument or debate in the debating society, that was actually critical, I think, to my education. And it became critical to me as a doctor. And I learned as a doctor that actually you do something which is immeasurably important, which cannot be measured in terms of facts. You learn that, for example, in front of you, you've got somebody who's desperately vulnerable, in pain, and at risk. They're worried about, they've got something seriously wrong with them, they think they're going to die, they're worried about money, they're about their family. And you, at that moment, have immense power over that individual. It's nothing to do with what you learn, but it's to do with your empathy and how you understand and get inside the position that that person in front of you is. And if you do that right, those patients never forget you. 30, 40, 50 years later, they still remember you. I just had a letter this week from somebody on whom I operated almost 55 years ago. And that letter pours out an extraordinary emotional consequence. And that woman remembers exactly what happened. I'd forgotten, of course, but she remembered. And that is a very, very common thing that we need to remember. We can do all sorts of things with that empathy. And, you know, the skill set is something that you learn as an apprentice, actually, rather than with just bald facts most of the time.
And I suppose, and that's, you know, certainly something that lots of people would have realised during the pandemic, if they or loved ones are being treated with coronavirus. And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? We remember that someone gave us great care, not the drug that they gave us or the treatment or whatever it is. The thing that you remember is the kindness and the care.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. Of course it is. And, you know, one of the things we've forgotten is that now, of course, because we've got this so-called diktat of personalized medicine based on your genetics, personalized medicine's become impersonal, because now, of course, the doctor looks at the computer screen rather than the face of the patient. And I think that's something we need to come back to, is to remember that actually touching somebody, listening to somebody, really trying to understand somebody is as healing as most of the drugs that we're able to give. Can I just come back to another issue with regard to opportunity? Is there time
to do
that? Well, I think one of the areas where we've got real opportunities, recognize we're going to have to change the way we teach. You know, at the moment, for example, you and I are conversing on Zoom. It's not ideal because actually we're not actually face to face, and you probably can't see my nuanced expressions and I can't see yours at all. But actually, there is no question that for some years now, universities have been working very hard on this sort of platform to teach regularly. And it's extraordinary, for example, that we're living in a society where suddenly computers are being handed out to schools without any training at all, without any protection at all. And, you know, we have not actually prepared ourselves for the time when really we're going to be doing a huge amount of communication electronically, virtually. Now, of course, that doesn't replace the face-to-face contact, but there's no question it becomes an important opportunity for us to do this far better. And at the moment, when you go on Zoom, and I'm sure you must do this with people, you see people, for example, sitting with their back to a bright window so you can't see their face. You know, simple stuff like that. And so we've got to learn to use these platforms and make certain that actually we are able to communicate much more effectively. And so one of the things is how we use a camera. So when you're using a camera, you've got to learn that actually you're talking to a person, not a camera. And there are a whole range of issues that we in my mind, that's an opportunity that really we've been losing. And now suddenly in a flurry of panic, you know, the Department of Education is suddenly handing out old computers to lots of children. But I mean, I don't know whether in fact they're protected against, their privacy is protected. I mean, a child using a computer at home, where in fact that computer is being fought over with three other children, or other siblings, and probably the parents as well in poorer families. You know, it's not an ideal situation. It's certainly better than nothing. But we should have been preparing for this much sooner. And you know, for some years, certainly at Imperial College where I work, we've been discussing online learning for the last 10 years. And so, you know, we could actually do quite a lot helping schools to do this better. In fact, our outreach program, in fact, after this interview with you, I've got going off to our outreach discussion about using Zoom in a particular way to really deal with some of the issues that primary school children have. So, you know, we are starting to use that platform, but it's very, very delayed. I mean, it's interesting. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke to 1,000 primary school children on Zoom, just answering questions. We had a children's question time, and it was an absolute riot. It was wonderful. You know, a whole series of state schools, about 24 of them, collaborated in the Midlands, and we just simply answered their questions for an hour or so. And then, of course, the emails as well. But you know, there really is a basis for thinking about how we could use this in a different way to help informally formal education.
And I suppose it's one of those things, and it's all been a bit of a lottery as to whether or not you had a teacher or a lecturer who enjoys technology and has thought about it and is imaginative, and others who, you know, teachers who like being in the classroom and don't like being online, their children suddenly find themselves at a bit of a disadvantage. I just wanted to ask you, just because I'm conscious of the time, about pregnancy and the experience of women, especially going through pregnancy during the pandemic. And again, lots of the decisions that were made about not having a partner in the room for scans and large parts of labour, that all goes back to those human interactions again, doesn't it? And the impact that they have.
Yes. Well, of course, one has to protect society. And of course, we have a prime responsibility not to spread this very, very infectious virus. But I think some of the decisions were made in panic. And I think really, you know, if somebody's been living with a pregnant woman for the last 9 months, it's pretty likely that if she's got the virus, you're going to get the virus anyway. And a huge number of people including some members of my family, have definitely had the virus without really being absolutely clear it was coronavirus. So, you know, I think, you know, much of the time, some of those precautions are probably hard. You know, I think there's been a real issue about not really looking at pregnancy properly. I would have thought, I was a bit disappointed. I felt the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is, you know, one of the colleges of which I'm a fellow, could have probably done a bit more about this, about really being a bit more upmarket about how a pregnancy might have been handled better. By the way, the other issue, of course, is that the terrible thing is not seeing your most close and loved ones as they're dying, not being able to be next to them.
Yeah.
And that was also, I think, a terrible shock when people suddenly realise they're not going to be able to do that.
We've talked an awful lot about education and the way things look going forward. Let's try and sort of end on an optimistic note. What do you think are the positives? Where do you think education might be in, I don't know, 12 months' time, 5 years' time? Presumably, hopefully not with Gavin Williamson still in charge. But well, I don't know. Maybe you're a fan. Maybe you're a fan.
I don't think the Department of Education has an easy job to do. But and I think education will still be probably a bit chaotic. It's bound to be for the next year or two. But in the long term, I don't think there will be a massive evidence of hugely deprived children now grown into adults who are unable to do work. I just don't think that will happen. I think we will learn new ways. And, you know, if you look at human history, you know, again and again, there have been major disasters which have affected societies. But the extraordinary thing is how rapidly human ingenuity and human fortitude and human character actually comes to the fore, and people not only survive, but actually thrive. And as you can see again and again, most of the big conflicts we've had in society have led to very, very important development.
Well, we've come to the end of this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. Listen to my Times Radio show every Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. You can listen on DAB Radio on your smart speaker. Get the Times Radio app. You can also listen to the Red Box podcast of the Times Radio app as well. And if you want to read about the stories that we've been talking about, then you need a Times subscription. To get that, go to times.radio/subscribe.